We got a real simple plan. One me and one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
You're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven. This might be college football heaven. Yeah.
This is ESPN's College Game Day Podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel, here's Reese Davis.
Everything is bigger in Texas. That includes this week. Wright State for a playoff interloper, but perhaps we had the wrong team. BYU's chance is here. And the great Gene Wojciechowski is with us. No one is a bigger help to me on College Game Day week in and week out. This is the College Game Day Podcast for Wednesday, September 14th. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel here, and Gene Wojciechowski is already joining us. Pete, you and I were talking before we started this podcast, and sometimes the best judge of the show are people who are fans but have a broader perspective. Both of our wives had the exact same reaction to Gene's piece last weekend, which detailed the coaches who had been fired and had gone into the, as Gene so aptly put it, into the Nick Saban witness protection program and came out on the other side better for it. I felt as if we do a number of pieces like this year to year. I think it's the best one we've ever done. And the reason I think that is because it's real easy to go in there and go, oh, Nick Saban touches all these coaches and they go get jobs, or to be snarky about it and say, everybody just hires Nick Saban coaches. And we got to a different level. My wife sensed that. It seems that yours did too, Pete.
Yeah, no, my wife, Kate. And again, in my house, there's a lot of hirings and firings, right? In a probably cold and bloodless transactional level, meaning like the last thing she said to me before she said that, she was like, oh, it's Sunday. Coaches get fired on Sunday when Scott Frost came up. So she sees that as an inconvenience to our family time. It is true, though. Coaches do get fired a lot on Sundays. So anyway, we were talking about the show a little bit, and she said that one, that like really – it really like touched me. Like those guys really like were bearing their souls about what it was like. And they didn't want to like bring their kids to practice or go to the grocery store. And it, and again, she has no idea who these coaches are, I want to be clear. So I think that was indicative of how it cut through, the story cut through at a human level. So you got some kudos in Southie, Gene, and I'd be curious how, you know, just how much time you put into it. Was it hard to convince these guys to bear their soul?
Yeah, well, two quick things. One, my wife doesn't even, like, I'll get home and she goes, oh, were you gone this week? I had no idea. And I need Reese to do my annual performance review moving forward. That would really be helpful. That is a story that we actually started working on. Barry Abrams was producer on it, and he actually pitched the story late spring, early summer, and started working on that thing in July, starting going to each of those campuses and, you know, Arkansas State and Ole Miss and Bama. And we got O'Brien also while we were at Bama, and going out to Texas to see Sarkisian, going to Maryland to see Michael Loxley. So we had the benefit of time during the summer. Usually during the season, it just doesn't work that way. It would have been nearly impossible to get all those guys into that story given the amount of time that we have that's compressed into our usual game day week. So that was a bonus. Relative to what you guys were mentioning about sort of the human aspect of it, that's what struck me also. And that's what helped make the story, I think, different. That these guys, you see them behind a podium, and there's this sort of cone of invincibility when they're talking to the media or talking to fans, or they're just in a different place once the season starts. Here we got them during the off season, and you could tell that just below the surface. And these are highly successful, highly paid people. But below the surface was a real human feeling of failure and a certain amount of embarrassment and shame, probably too strong of a word. But as Butch Jones said in the piece, it's the lowest moment I've ever felt in my life for me and my family. So clearly, even years in some cases after they've been fired, it still hurt. and just like it would hurt us. And it didn't matter how much money you got paid the previous year, Butch Jones, $4 million. It still hurt for someone to tap you on the shoulder and say, you're not good enough. Get out of here. And I think we forget that sometimes. Fans forget it sometimes, that these are human beings. And it hurts when someone tells you, you're not good enough. We need you to leave. Please clear out your office and get out.
A lot of times when people experience that, most times I would say, I mean, people want to move on from their failures. Why do you think they wanted to talk to you about it?
I don't know how to answer that one, Reese. I would like to think in most of these cases with these coaches, I've dealt with them in the past. So I hope that there's a certain amount of trust there, that they knew I wasn't there to embarrass them or to mock them or to, I don't know, somehow treat their journey and that firing and that lowest professional moment in a way that would be anything but respectful. So I hope that was part of it. But I also think it was a way to get to the other point, which was I was at my lowest moment, and then here was this guy, not arguably, the greatest college football coach of all time and maybe the greatest football coach of all time. And he was there and he was going to extend a hand to me. And that meant something to me. So I'm going to take you from the lowest to, in a sense, the highest point. And the only way I can get there is to describe you how bad it was when I got canned, when I got the pink slip, when someone kneecapped me. And on the other end of it was this guy, Nick Saban, to try to help me out. So maybe that had something to do with it. And maybe like all of us, Reese, they just needed to vent. They wanted to explain how it really, really felt.
Can I ask a little inside baseball question here, Gene? I think one of the things Reese and I've tried to do on the pod is give people a little peek behind the curtain at game day. And I've been a game day employee for about 12 minutes now. And one of the things that I've learned is how talented the producers are who work on those features. And that was probably what, a 5 minute feature, Gene ish.
Yeah. Four minutes
or five. Okay. 4 or 5 minutes. Yeah. Give people a sense. And I really had no idea until I recently did a feature with Mike O'Connor on Marcus Freeman, how much time, how many trips, how many hours of film get condensed into those 4 minutes. And then what the real magic is, which is hard to quantify, is how the producer ninjas mix it all together to really make it a digestible, forward moving, quick, compelling narrative.
Well, I'm glad you asked that about the producers, because we have some fantastic ones, and they deserve more than a few pats on the back. But again, this was a little unusual because we had the benefit of time and summer and extra traveling. But in this case, I think Barry Abrams traveled to two of the campuses with me. I went to the other ones. Each interview might last, I don't know, 20 minutes, half hour. It just depends. Maybe Lane Kiffin was 40 minutes. Loxley was 45. Nick Saban was 15 or 20. Bill O'Brien, because of Alabama's policies regarding assistant coaches, he wasn't able to come into the room and sit with us. That's just Saban's rule during the season. So we actually had to shoot that during O'Brien's annual meet the press moment. So there was an entire room full of local press there. So, Barry came up with a way to try to shoot that where it looked like it was more of a one-on-one interview. So those are the sort of things that a producer has to deal with. The producer will arrange our crews. He will work with the media relations people at the schools, try to get us the right room, the right setting. So there's a lot of little things that go into it. And then once the interviews are shot and once I write the script, I send it into them, to Barry, and he'll take a look at it. Then we have another sort of producer that oversees the field producers. His name is Ben Weber. and they'll go through the script and say, we want you to change this. This is fine. Great. Then you track the piece, which is basically narrating your script in parts. And then off they go back in Bristol and in the editing room. And a lot of the magic, as you said, and a lot of the feel happens in that editing room. Barry will work with an editor, and they'll just know when they're looking at it what works and what doesn't work. And then we'll have various drafts of Vimeos, we call them, of that piece. And we'll go through it, I don't know, sometimes 10 times, 5 times. It just depends on where we are as far as the health of the piece. So it is definitely a collaborative process. And it's pretty interesting to see how the sausage is made. And in this case, Barry and Ben and the editor did a wonderful job sort of putting that all together and bringing that script to life. And occasionally they'll let me weigh in, and sometimes they'll listen, sometimes they won't. Again, they have the best vantage point from that edit room. So it's cool to see it all come together and turn into a piece that you'll see on Saturday morning.
Before we move on, there's one quick thing I want to mention. Check out our friend Scott Van Pelt and Stanford Steve on SV Pod. It's important to note that SV Pod is the only podcast on our roster that's recapping Saturdays and Sundays on the gridiron. This week, they look back at week one of the NFL and shared which upset they enjoyed the most from week 3 of college football. Check out SV Pod. Follow the show wherever you're listening to this podcast. The editing was phenomenal, particularly off the top of the piece, and even little shots like when Loxley was talking about having to take the kids to the swimming pool that front when he was running Alabama's football camp. Everything.
Well, let me add one thing, Reese. And one of the things, you know, again, we probably did, I don't know, 5 hours of shooting, and 4 minutes makes it. And out of that, probably 3 minutes is actual sound from the coaches. So think about that for a moment. But one of the things that we weren't able to put into the piece was, at the time, Loxley had basically crashed at Lane Kiffin's apartment at this building. And you know the layout of Bama much better than I do, having gone there. But he mentioned an apartment building that overlooks the football facility. I don't know where that is exactly. You probably would. Anyway, it was whatever floor it was, the 10th floor of this apartment building, or 7th floor. And Loxley was basically grabbed a couch and was just going to stay with Kiffin so he could save some money. And he calls Kiffin as he's walking the kids over to the pool. And he's like, Lane, this is the absolute rock bottom for me. And Kiffin goes, yeah, I know. I'm watching you. I'm watching you from the apartment. And he's laughing at Loxley. And you know, he's taking video of Loxley walking the kids over. And we begged Lane, can you please find that video so we could use it in the story? And he looked. He really tried to find it.
I'm sure he did.
But those guys know. I mean, Lane and Loxley had been in the same position. And really, Lane had something to do with more than a few of those coaches ending there. I mean, he talked to Loxley about it. He talked to Sarkisian about coming to Bama. So there really is this Kevin Bacon, you know, 6 degrees thing at Bama. But at the end of the day, it really is cool that Saban, and he had the equity, as you mentioned on the show, to pull this off. And that other coaches, and I think Pete has mentioned this, other coaches are beginning, head coaches are beginning to look at that sort of talent pool of fired head coaches to bring them into their program.
Well, look, I mean, it was evident Saturday because Gary Patterson, I don't want to take away from Kwiatkowski, but I would find it stunning if he didn't have a heavy hand in the evaluation and preparation of the game plan on Saturday. I want to ask one more question about your piece, though, Gene. And that was one thing. It's funny I said that. I do a show review every week. And one of the things I put in the show review is when we have someone on, you don't have to say, I want to ask a question. Just ask the question. So I'm going to do that now. How did you find that the coaches who had gone in and had to do some tasks that really below their level of expertise and sat in the outfield as opposed to the infield. And the perhaps, while some gratitude in the moment, but maybe a little irritation, not resentment, but irritation with Saban and the demanding ways that it goes. How did you find that that changed once they moved back into the big seat?
Well, you have to understand, and this won't surprise either one of you because you've dealt with Nick Saban. There's no confusion about what your role is when you get there. That's part of the deal. And when each of those guys, let's say Butch Jones, who had competed against Saban at Tennessee and the SEC at the highest level, and ran his program, and this was a upper echelon program, and now he's banished. I mean, he's an analyst. He's not even an assistant coach. He's making what do you say, 30,000, 35,000 a year. But when he comes in there, and it happened with each of these guys, Saban tells him what you're going to do. And here's what I expect from you. And if you can't deal with this, then you don't need to be here. So unless you know going in, you're going to be in the outfield. And you're not going to say a word unless I ask you to say something. And one of the things that Kiffin said, and again, he was hired as an offensive coordinator and was in the infield. He said, like at one of the early meetings, Saban said something and Kiffin started chiming in and everybody looked at him like they wanted to put a knitting needle into his eye, was that it was rhetorical. Saban doesn't want you to speak unless he asks you to speak. And it's even tenfold that when you're in the outfield. And as Sarkisian said in the piece, it's like sitting at the kids' table on Thanksgiving dinner. You know, you are out of sight and you just have to deal with it. So then when you move to the infield, I think you have a greater appreciation for the outfield people, first of all. And secondly, there's a sense of accomplishment. You have worked your way to the outer ring, from the outer ring to the inner circle. And so, but again, they know going in, this is what's expected of you. If you can't deal with it, you probably shouldn't say yes to this job.
I think what I was wondering, though, was more so when they got their own jobs again. Because I know from a few of the guys, some that were in the piece and some that weren't, it was really irritating. Why is he like this? Why does he make us do this? Why does he make us do that? And then when they get back into the chair, I've heard a couple of them say, I go, oh, I get it. I understand that. Even though they've been head coaches before, did you find any of that?
Absolutely. Look, Lane Kiffin won't make any secret of it. I don't think I'm divulging any state secrets here with him. But, you know, he certainly chafed under the thumb of Saban, even as a member of the infield and as an assistant coach there. He didn't understand it in a way. But once he got out, and I think he's applied some of those things that he witnessed and learned under Nick at his own programs now. Steve Sarkisian said he went there mostly because he wanted to learn how Nick Saban did things. And Michael Loxley had other opportunities to go work for other programs as full-time assistants. He was even kicking the tires on NFL teams, and they were kicking them on him also. But he went to a place where he wanted to learn and be uncomfortable. And you definitely are uncomfortable with Nick Saban at times. So I think that's the trade-off. Yes, it's irritating. It's annoying. You don't understand it. Hey, I was a head coach. Why are you talking to me like this? But once you get out, it's like being a kid and you don't understand your parents. But as you get older and you're raising your own kids, all of a sudden, now it makes sense. My kids don't actually believe in any of that, but I like to believe that it makes a difference.
I'd be curious from Reese and from Gene. We've all done this a long time. We've dealt with a lot of fired coaches, right? And Reese, you've quite frankly worked with a lot of fired coaches. Mm-hmm. Football, basketball on broadcast. That's usually you don't walk off the championship stage and go into the color booth. So I think the psyche of the fired coach is fascinating because they, it's almost like someone who's gone through a bad divorce. Like they, it's hard years later, it's hard to shake it. And I'd be curious, Reese, from all the different guys you've worked with, like, did Bobby Knight still complain about Indiana, you know, like 10 years later or however long it was then? I'd just be curious a little bit of that, of that perspective, because that those firings, when they're public and you're in the spotlight, I felt like over the years with the coaches I've dealt with, they don't go away.
Mm-hmm. You're right. All of them that I've dealt with, that sting doesn't go away. Bob was a little bit different because I think, you know, he believed that it was unjustified, you know, what had happened in there. And it's been well documented that until recently, he didn't have any intentions of, or fairly recently, intentions of going back to Indiana because of the hard feelings. I'm glad that that has been resolved, apparently, you know, given especially some of the things that Bob's going through right now. But I think for the most part, it is because it's one of the things that we all meet as a challenge in life. No matter how important you think your job is, whether it's the host of College Game Day or the head coach at Alabama or the head coach at Maryland or wherever it is, that's not your life. You think it is, but your life is how your family greets you when you come home every night. I heard a wise man say that one time. And I think that there's a bit of a reality shock for the guys who've been fired and come into broadcasting. They realize that when everything was at their fingertips and they were running everything and everybody was, yes, coach, what can I get for you, coach? And all of a sudden now you have to get your own coffee or you have to, you know, pick up your own dry cleaning or whatever it is. I think there's a little bit of a shake back into reality. But there is also among those guys, I won't say universally, but near universally, a bit of an addiction to the game. The one thing I'll say out of all of the guys, and I don't really view Bob in the same way because he went to Texas Tech and then left of his own volition and came to us, which we were grateful for. But I think the other guys, there's almost an addiction to stay close to it, to talk to other coaches, to be involved and to know what's going on. And, you know, I would imagine that would be the same in broadcasting too. That's at least that's my experience with them. I haven't found in working with them that they spend a lot of time complaining. There may be the occasional slipped in joke, about getting fired, a pink slip, or that guy fired me or whatever, but not, sort of the self-deprecating kind of joke. But there's not a lot of, you know, moaning about, I got fired, this guy, I can't believe he did that. That hasn't been my experience. And generally, when I work with these guys, I spend a lot of time with them. You know, it's riding to the airport, eating dinner, in studio with some of the guys who've been in studio, you spend hours, you know, day after day with them. So I haven't found a lot of them to be sitting around complaining, but you do get that sense of that Gene talked about it. I don't know if it's Gene's right. It's not shame. It's a little embarrassment, as we all would have if we had something that didn't go the way we'd hoped in a very public way. Gene, one quick one here. I know you don't like to give away what you're doing on College Game Day, but you've got a fascinating story coming up that'll air this weekend in Boone. You never do this in the meeting. Gene, about the story in the meeting, and he will like give you the most bare bones. So without giving away the great moments, tell us a little bit about the story we're going to see Saturday on College Game Day.
Well, just so your people know why I do that, our producer, Jim Guerrero, I do it partly just to exasperate him. But mostly I do it because when you guys watch the feature, if there's time after the feature airs, I want you to be able to react in the moment. And I don't want you to know what's going to happen in the feature. I don't want you to know the details of the feature. I want you to be able to react organically and honestly and true to the moment. And if you're so moved. And if you're not, then you dismiss it and you move on to the, Akron, Tennessee game. But But so partly I do that because I want you guys to see the piece in real time and be able to react in real time. So that's mostly why I try to keep the details to the minimum. And of course, just to get Jimmy G. But this week, yes, we're doing a piece on Eric Aull Jr. He's a tight end at Michigan. He's a one of the team captains. And the truth is he wouldn't be at Michigan, wouldn't be a team captain, wouldn't ever play football, had something not happened to him when he was 5 months old in a little town of Richmond, Indiana, on the second floor of a burning house. And so we are going to tell the story of a kid whose life that almost wasn't, and of a kid who's made the most out of that life, and who was granted a second chance, sort of, you know, Jimmy Stewart, It's a Wonderful Life sort of theme in a way. And the man who helped make that possible. And then a meeting between this team captain at the University of Michigan and the guy years later who was mostly responsible for seeing that Eric Aull Jr. had this life. So it was a really cool process to delve into the story and to ultimately put them together in a moment that I hope will resonate with people when they see the story on Saturday.
Can I get one more question with Gene?
Yeah. Okay.
While we have him here very quickly, I don't think I'm giving away state secrets that week four, Gene's beloved Tennessee Volunteers are hosting a high profile home game against number 18, Florida. Certainly the decisions of where College Game Day go are a few office levels above my basement cubicle, but I don't think I'm speaking out of turn to say two top 20 teams in a presumably rabid environment with a starved fan base would be a potential College Game Day site. Gene, I'm just curious, with your long institutional knowledge of Knoxville and Tennessee, how you think the local community there would react, and would you be excited to roll back?
Well, Reese knows this as well as anybody. We, for some reasons, it still astounds me. We have a love-hate relationship with the Tennessee faithful. It goes back years and years ago relative to Peyton Manning and the Heisman and some comments that were, I believe, misconstrued by Tennessee fans. I would tell them to get over it. I think most have. But I think we would be welcomed with open arms. The times that we have gone back there, it's been fantastic. And it, to me, and I would say this even if I wasn't a graduate of University of Tennessee, I think it's one of the great Saturday settings in college football. And if it so happens that we go back there, I think we'll have a great time and I think we'll have a great show. But I know there's still some other games in play and some other things that could happen. But, you know, of course, I'd love to go back there. I always love going back to Knoxville. So, but yeah, I think it would be a great scene. But wherever we end up, hey, happy to be there.
This political announcement is brought to you by Wojciechowski for Vols.
Yes. That message is approved by me.
Hey, what was your jersey number at Tennessee, Gene?
It's the same as one of the Stoop kids, number 12.
There you go. That's a good uni number.
It's a good uni number. Unfortunately, it never saw the field. It was very much a sideline bench number.
Where yeah, it belonged. But if you're wearing 12 and you're not out there, then people in the stands are going, they should put 12 in the game. I mean, if you're like 43 or something, I don't know. That's probably a bad one. That's Darren Sproles. But you know, there's some numbers that nobody notices. They notice 12.
Yeah, 59 is not a good number.
Yeah, especially for a wide receiver. I mean, yes. What you were. Yeah. If you were 59 and a wide receiver, you're not going in.
I was way wide of the field. So
anyway, what was Game Day's last trip there, Gene?
No, we were there, I don't know, 5-6 years ago?
Yeah, right. Butch in Florida, against Florida.
Okay.
All right. Maybe 17, maybe 16 okay. or 17 somewhere.
That sounds about right. Yeah, we did it up on the hill, I think.
Yeah. It was great. It was fun. We had Spurrier and Fulmer.
They were good.
Doing guest pictures. Yeah. Fulmer was surprisingly good.
Yes.
surprisingly good. But
I'll add this little nugget.
Gators.
19 years I've covered national college football. I've never seen a game at Tennessee. Wow. And I pretty much traveled weekly for 19 years. Now, again, there might have been a game I could have gone to and went to another one, whatever it was. But yeah, so I'd be thrilled because that's I've been to campus and I've been to Knoxville. It's a great, great town. But yeah, I'd be pretty fired up to see the old Gators go in. And we're open to all sailgating invitations too. So just
the one thing I would say about seeing a game there, it's great to have a media pass unless they've changed things, Gene, because those seats are made for really, really skinny jeans. Really. I mean, if you weigh over 138, it's tough to squeeze into your assigned area there. Yeah. Am I being fair about that, Gene? That's true, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. You want to have a suite there or be in the press box or watch a game from a boat on the river. But, there's a reason why they're over 100,000 all the time or used to be because they squeeze everybody in there. But, yeah, Pete, we got to get you there just to see you regardless of game day.
Let's roll.
All right. Well, thank you, fellas, for having me on today.
All right, Gino. Great to talk to you, buddy.
Thanks, Gene. Great work.
All right, Pete, looking ahead to the games this week, you know, in the preseason, I picked Utah to go to the playoff. And I said on game day Saturday morning, I don't think they're out of it. And I don't. I think there's still an opportunity there because this season looks as if it might be one that's turned upside down. But I might have had the right state and the wrong team. And with BYU beating Baylor and with the opportunity now in front of them, still solid, but maybe not as daunting as it appeared in the preseason, meaning that their game at Oregon this week maybe doesn't look quite the same as it did prior to that debacle the Ducks had against Georgia. And then Notre Dame, obviously, with its issues. Arkansas at home will be a handful for sure. But let's look at this week. If BYU is going to start saying, boy, could these guys do this? Could they run the table? Here's a big opportunity for them, regardless of what you think of the Ducks at the moment with, you know, Bo Nix played better last week, but it was against Eastern Washington. Even one of his touchdown passes should have been a pick probably. But, you know, here's the opportunity. It's right here after just a terrific win against Baylor the other night.
Yeah, if you are going to be a team that's outside the Power Five, and BYU is obviously an independent until they join the Big 12 next year, you not only have to be perfect, but you also have to have a schedule that allows you to have a case. And you have to have a little bit of preseason juice. It's hard to go from completely unranked to assert yourself in the conversation. If you think back to some of those Boise teams back when they were in the WAC, they'd start the season ranked unranked or in the 20s, and it is just a tar fight to get to the, you know, it used to be one or two then, so that was really hard. But, you know, even to get to four, BYU sitting there at 12 now, and look, Oregon's ranked 25th. They obviously laid a dinosaur egg. You go into Autzen Stadium and you win, that's a big deal. I don't care, you know, if this isn't a vintage Ducks team and Dan Lanning's finding his sea legs and Bo Nix is a little bit erratic, perhaps. Like that is one of the tougher venues to play in all of college football. So I really feel like right now, sitting here going into the weekend of September 17th, BYU's got a chance. They have an elite quarterback, which is just going to help their case, right? Like Jaren Hall is as good as any quarterback in the country. He's a top five college football quarterback. They have an elite offensive line that's going to have four NFL prospects, I was told by some scouts who've gone through there this year. Freeland, their left tackle, is a potential first-round pick. He's massive. He's 6'8", up in the threes. They have two NFL tight ends. They have a lot of skill, some of which didn't play against Baylor. late Saturday night. I was pretty tired by the time that game came around, Reese. I will admit that. I don't know how you kept your energy through that whole Stanford game because by the time old 11 o'clock Central hit, I was pretty. It'd been a long day in Austin. I'd sweat out enough gravy, as Pollock likes to say, to where I was pretty tired. But like BYU has the potential to have a handful of marquee wins. And I don't care if Notre Dame's unranked when they play them. Like that's still an excellent program with good players, and it's going to be a big time venue. So like the case is here for BYU. Now they have to go be perfect. That's not easy to do. I think the evolution they showed last year, Baylor stoned them in the run game last year. Baylor ran it down their throats in Waco. And there was obviously significant evolution and adjustment to where Baylor couldn't move the ball when you looked at Saturday night. I think they averaged around 2 yards a rush. So there's a lot of traits about this BYU program that I really like. And I was bullish on them. Our podcast listeners would know early in the season. I'm claiming that I'm right, because I haven't been right about much in terms of my picks. So I'm gonna claim I was an early BYU bandwagon adoptee, and I'm gonna still ride it.
I thought they would lose two of these games off the top first half of the season. That's why I wasn't as high on them. Now it looks a little different, and they look better than I thought. I, like you, am a believer in Jaren Hall. I mean, he's already thrown for 500 yards, 3 touchdowns, first couple of games. He's a threat to run. He's going to have an opportunity to really make himself known to the pro scouts and the greater landscape of college football fans as well. Best in Game brought to you by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises. Jaren Hall has been terrific, but their quarterback situation is clear-cut at BYU. All of a sudden, not as clear-cut as Texas. Texas plays UTSA this week, a really talented team that's played two gut-punching games, won one, lost one. Lost to Houston, pulled one out of the fire against Army. But Texas now, without Quinn Ewers for a few weeks, Hudson Card was hobbling around at the end of the Alabama game. I believe that this week is more important to Texas than last week. Now, I probably wouldn't have said that had the game gone as most thought it would, gone as scripted, and Alabama had won by 20. But because of the way Texas played, particularly the way it played on defense, you've got to follow that up. You have to. And that means winning the games you're supposed to win. And regardless of your quarterback situation, and regardless of how good the Roadrunners are, and they're very good. I talked to a coach who played against them already this season last night, and just marveling at the skill and athleticism that they show and the depth of that. Texas has to win that game. They've got to play well. They can't, have a hangover from the disappointment at the end of the Alabama game. And because if you do, then it's just, okay, they got up to play Alabama. Everybody gets up to play Alabama. And so they have to follow it up regardless of their quarterback situation.
I agree. And I'm certainly not a doctor, but Hudson Card didn't look right at the end of that game. And he said after the game, I was in interviews, that he has an ankle injury, and it's just hard to imagine him humming at 100%. Now, it's a great test of the Texas program and how it's evolved, how that offensive line has evolved. Can you just line up, play conservative, run Bijan Robinson, hit Xavier Worthy with some bubbles, and just beat up an inferior talented opponent? Can you do that? Can you, be creative, get Jordan Whittington the ball a little bit, and just move the ball seamlessly, control a game, and win 21-10? Like that to me is a huge, huge issue. Now, look, the Texas defense especially played exponentially better against Alabama than I would have thought. And I think there was an element of just like toughness there. They obviously self-inflicted some wounds, but there wasn't a time where you were like, they're getting manhandled up front. And that was a case a lot with Texas, especially last season. I mean, they just didn't dominate anyone. I think of Keandre Coburn running around, all 340 pounds of him or whatever at the nose. They are better. Deshaun Jameson is injured, by the way, which is just, when you play UTSA with that skill, he's obviously Texas's best corner. That's certainly something that, to keep an eye on. So I think it's a fascinating test. I mean, for every single Roadrunner, a vast majority of whom are from Texas, this is their Super Bowl. This is bigger than any bowl game. This is bigger than any Conference USA title game. This is the game they're going to go tell their grandkids about. Jeff Traylor, longtime, uber-successful Texas high school coach, former Texas assistant, I mean, they are going to throw everything into this, and I'd be naive to not project that. I think it's going to be a close game.
Yeah, I think it'll be close also. And they don't have, UTSA doesn't have a quarterback issue. Frank Harris, Conference USA Player of the Week again, already got, I think he's already accounted for 7 touchdowns and over 750 yards. And look, they were on the ropes last week against Army, and he pulled them back. And, you know, before anyone says, oh, it's just Army, I mean, you know, Army's gone into really good Oklahoma teams and given them a fight. I mean, we touched on Michigan, and we touched on Munkin a little bit relative to the Nebraska job last week. So our respect for him is evident. And UTSA is a same goes for Traylor. He's done a phenomenal job there. And Texas has its hands full, because one thing that happens when you play Alabama, even though for the great majority of that game, Texas was every bit as physical and physically imposing, if not more so, than Alabama. But you typically come out of that game mm-hmm. pretty battered, you know, pretty mm-hmm. bumped up and bruised. And there's certainly an emotional drain, but there's a bit of a physical drain too. And this is not perfect scheduling to have the Roadrunners rolling in the week after you go through that. So I think there's some difficulty there coming up for Texas. Got a few categories.
Can I sneak in a quick thought on another smaller team?
It was in the back of my mind for BYU. I just want to plant the flag for Air Force a little bit here. They're 2-0. I think they will be favored in a vast majority of their remaining games, if not all of them. They play Friday night against Wyoming. And I just really think that they've, again, take COVID year out, I think they won 10 and 20 and then 11 and 19. You know, they're amid a pretty special stretch for that program. And they absolutely ragdolled Colorado. I don't know if Chris Fowler's like shown his face outside his house the way his alma mater got beaten up. That was just an absolute butt kicking. We have to evaluate everything about our program. And so I just think it is going to be hard. Air Force is still unranked, right? It is going to be very hard for Air Force to really come and take on the scene. But let's not be surprised if in mid-October they're not sitting there 7-0 going to play Boise and they're not in the conversation. As usual with Air Force, they are led by a fullback, Brad Roberts, who's averaging a cool 9 yards a carry. He's fifth in the nation in rushing, and he is every bit of like that tough, what you'd want from an Air Force fullback, right? Tough-minded and such. So anyway, thus ends my Air Force TED Talk, but I think they've slid under the radar a little bit, and I'm excited to get, you know, really get a chance to watch them on Friday night play the Pokes.
Yeah, Roberts has been effective. He was a 1,000-yard rusher last year. Even last year, they were the only team in the top 10 in rushing offense and rushing defense. That's a great call. If this is one of those 2007-esque years where things get turned upside down, maybe it's the BYUs and the Air Forces rather than the near misses or the ones just lurking on the edge of the outside, like Cincinnati was last year, meaning outside the Power Five. Cincinnati, or I thought Houston might be that team, haven't been blown away by what I've seen from Houston. And that brings me to another game in the category with UTSA and Texas of games that might be trickier than they look initially on paper. Kansas and Houston. Houston already dropped one. They're lucky they're not 0-2, frankly, after, you know, pulling one out against UTSA. And now Kansas coming off a win at West Virginia, too. I Lance Leipold's a really, really good coach. He got a good quarterback. The Jayhawks could make another little statement right here if they could knock off Houston.
Yeah, I mean, the bursts of Kansas football optimism post Mark Mangino could be fit on a fortune cookie, right? Like, I mean, there just has not been a lot to like. It has been as bad of a spiral. They like doubled down, terrible football hires with terrible athletic director hires, and then they kept getting worse somehow. So right now with Lance Leipold and Travis Goff in charge there, there's a prioritization of football. I thought it was important. They extended Lance Leipold by a year right before the season started. They were saying, hey, we believe in this guy. We went and won in Austin last year. You know, they were, I believe, 2-10 last year, but there was just a sense of this is progress. This is happening. If you looked at their, you know, their average margin in league games, two years ago compared to last year, there was a significant, I want to say like a 2-touchdown difference in that. So Lance Leipold has him rolling. Jalen Daniels is a very good quarterback. I mean, Morgantown's a hard place to win for Big 12 schools. A lot of dreams have gone and died in Morgantown over the years. And the fact that they went in there, they were down 2 touchdowns, stormed back, held on in overtime. It was just as impressive of a run, as impressive of a win as you've seen. So here you are for Kansas. They've already matched their win totals for last year. And I just think if you look at the overall talent upgrade at Kansas, I saw a bunch of their coaches at some satellite camps this spring. And, you know, you start asking them just your basic questions of, hey, where are you better? And the answers were just, we have upgraded. 45% of the roster has flipped since Leipold got there. And there's just a feeling that they have upgraded, you know, just significantly across the board, especially athleticism-wise, especially defense. And we're just going to put it on the game day list, just put it on the long list. If they win in Houston on Saturday, the mighty Duke Blue Devils, they have an FCS team this weekend. We could have the clash of 3-0 traditional bottom feeders, all right? Duke goes to Lawrence, and Mike Krzyzewski, Bill Self, John Shire will not be involved. And it could be a game of significance. The winner of that game could get ranked. So, you know, good on Kansas and good on Duke for making that part of the conversation and not making that game a punchline, which it would have been, quite frankly, last year.
Well, they play in the Champions Classic, and that's the other thing. Leipold's done a good job there, and the early returns are that that Mike Elko is a perfect fit, just like a well-fitting pair of trousers. You know, things just sort of, you know, make you more confident, make you feel better, and Duke's much better there. Duke and Kansas would be something. I think it would be an experience for some of our football only guys. I've been to Larrytown so many times for basketball. It'd be cool to be there for football, but I don't know that I'd get a, wow, this is new, you know, feeling like I'm going to get in Boone this week or something. So, yeah. But I would be excited to go there for football, because when I was there for basketball, I'd never met Lance Leipold before. And I was able to visit with him for a while this basketball season. Really sharp guy, really impressive dude.
I want to tell a funny story.
Please do. Please do. That's what this is about.
I've known Lance Leipold for a bit, and it was the Monday night of the national title game.
He was with a Kansas contingent that flew down for the weekend. So we'd been texting just throughout the Final Four, and I was, you know, you get to these games 3-4 hours early or whatever if you're a reporter. So I went to go see Lance Leipold in the stands. And Lance is a son of Wisconsin, modest guy, you know, sort of just a Midwestern. He'd been in, you know, worked in Nebraska for 12 years. And, you know, he's in with the Kansas VIPs. Like, you name a Kansas basketball All-American, they're there. So we're chatting. And I won't say which Kansas legend it was, because I don't want to be mean. But Lance is like, hey, give me a second, Pete. I want to go get a picture with this guy. So no problem. So Lance goes over, shakes his hand, and this former Kansas All-American had no idea who he was. None.
You got it.
Lance, to his credit, is very deprecating. He gets a picture. I might have taken the picture. I don't remember. He walks back over, looks at me, goes, oh, yeah. He had no clue that I was a Kansas football coach.
Paul Pierce.
It might have been Paul Pierce. Austin's own Paul Pierce. It was Paul Pierce. Yeah.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was Paul Pierce.
It
was New Orleans. So, you know, Paul Pierce might have had some pregame festivities that, that you know, didn't involve a museum. I will say this.
What are you saying, Pete?
A few minutes later, Danny Manning was there, and he popped over to do the same thing, got a picture with Danny Manning. And Danny Manning, she says, like, Coach, you're doing a great job. Like, Danny Manning was, like, locked in and knew it. But it was just sort of me. I was like, that's a little bit of the portrait of what it's like to be a Kansas football coach.
Danny Manning is one of the all-time good guys. When you consider the level of accomplishment that he's had in his life, he is one of the kindest, nicest, most professional people you'll ever meet. I like Danny a lot. That's not surprising that he knew exactly who it was. I want to hit you with, not to take us to negative town before we go, group of games that sound better on paper than they'll actually be. Well, you don't sound on paper. You know what I mean? You look at the, you look at them and go, boy, that sounds like a big game. Penn State, Auburn, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Michigan State, Washington. All those sound like really brands. Good games.
Brands.
Yeah, big brands. And I'm not terribly enthused about any of them. Maybe there's some curiosity surrounding Oklahoma, Nebraska, but that's different from being enthused and thinking I'm going to be, I think this is going to be some great football game.
Yeah, we'll start there. The interim dynamic is always interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Especially as this trend of early firings has come upon us. The fire of Scott Frost is actually later than the earliest firing of last season. Because remember, Randy Edsall got run basically Labor Day weekend after they laid a huge egg in week zero at Fresno last year. Remember the game where UConn's cleats were melting because it was so mm-hmm. hot on the field. Mm-hmm. So we've had like a little bit more experience with interims and what they could do and how they could do it. Mickey Joseph's an impressive guy. I mean, who has brought together and developed better wide receivers in the last handful of years than when you think of that 19 LSU team and like the real dudes that they had at receiver. I mean, those guys are the best guys in the NFL right now. When you look at Jefferson and Chase, I mean, he's got a great reputation and he's going to give that program an energy jolt and the new voice that Trev Alberts wants. So I'll be curious. The danger of the interim is you change too much and then everything really spirals. So can he bring a new energy and enough wrinkles to sort of flummox Oklahoma as opposed to trying to change too much? I will be very curious to see how they respond. And I think a lot of the $7.5 million decision that Trev Alberts made will be judged on how they respond in this game.
You know, he's been around the ultimate interim coach from his time with Ed Orgeron, who, you know, has mastered the craft of being the interim coach. I'm sure they're
started and ended. There.
Yeah. You know, right? the thing is, I thought one of the things that occurred to me as it pertains to Mickey and his playing career at Nebraska, you know, the old stage adage to wish someone well is to tell them to break a leg. That probably isn't what he wants to hear in the Oklahoma week, because if memory serves, I think he suffered a broken leg against Oklahoma in that game back when he was a player too. So there, he's got a little history within the long and storied one in this particular rivalry. Are you as bleh about Penn State and Auburn as I am?
Well, I'm excited to see Nick Singleton, who broke out against
Ohio last week. And he has been, I went through Penn State in the spring, watched him in a practice, listened to the coaches, Jaywon Sider, the running back coach, James Franklin, Yursich. I mean, people were buzzing about this kid and he has lived up to every bit of it so far. He was a monster against Ohio last week. So I think I'm most curious to see, can they go in and run the ball down Auburn's throat? It's Phil Troutwine has overhauled that offensive line. It, you know, no better test than an SEC opponent. And I guess some of my intrigue from the Auburn side is
can they complete a forward pass?
Yes, that. But also, if they lose, does this start the, you know, their AD search is going on now. There's a lot of people kind of buzzing about that in AD circles, like. Does this start the sort of what we've all assumed is the inevitable exit of Brian Harsin, which is not some like manufactured media thing. They tried to get rid of him through that just totally ridiculous, baseless witch hunt in February. So they have brought the program spiral upon themselves. And now it's sort of just like, how do they begin some sort of exit? And if Penn State goes in and wins authoritatively, that is where this, you know, Auburn season sadly goes. They completely like Tonya Hardinged his knees for lack of a better way to put it. So I guess I'm intrigued by that game for a couple of things. I think Penn State's going to be better. I know Kirk has been very bullish on Penn State, mm-hmm. very vocal about it as the bandwagoner of the Sean Clifford fan club. I'm an early Nick Singleton adoptee from seeing him this spring. So let's go. Hey, look, that's a hard place to play. Let's go see if they can let it rip there and be be in the Big Ten conversation. And I think if you go win there, you're in the playoff conversation.
I agree with you about excitement about Penn State. I think my lack of enthusiasm for the game itself is just questioning Auburn's ability in the passing game. I mean, TJ Finley has, had moments, and then he throws the ball to the wrong team. And, you know, Robbie Ashford is a guy that I really liked in high school and never really got it going at Oregon, never really got the chance. And, you know, there are moments at Auburn, maybe, you know, maybe he's the guy, and then the whole Zach Calzada thing is a bit of a mystery. I think that's what's going to happen. Auburn's got some dudes on defense, and it won't come initially. But I think over the course of the game, Auburn's going to have such a hard time moving the ball that Penn State eventually will be able to move the ball. I think Penn State will win. And I'm not talking like an ugly blowout or anything, but I think it'll be a decisive road win. It'll be a good win. But the Harsin exit is going to happen one way or the other. If I'm wrong about Auburn and they play better in the passing game and they beat Penn State and they go on a run and have a really good season, then Harsin's gone because he'll find another job to take. If it goes the other way, then he's gone for the reasons you say. So this is going to happen. The question is when and how. And, you know, at least to me, I don't think there's no coming back from what happened in the offseason from that long term. If there is any reprieve, it's temporary. There's no coming back from this. This is over. The question is when. And I would be stunned if it's not over one way or the other at the end of this year. It may be at the end of a 10-win Auburn season or at the end of a mediocre one, because I think they've got decent talent. They're not going to, you know, go out and just stink it up in any game that they play, but this is not going to last long term. The powers that be there didn't want it to last. They pushed out one of the best young athletic directors in the game for some inexplicable reason. And so now they get to do what they want, and they'll start over and get different guys.
Worth noting, Reese, in composite recruiting rankings right now, Auburn is 14th of 14 SEC schools. And that is not an indictment of Brian Harsin. That is an indictment of a lack of faith in recruits in high school. If you're a high school coach, it'd be hard in good faith to send a player to Auburn and say, hey, this is what it's going to look like your next 5 years. And this should be when his recruiting is really hitting its stride. And instead, they are well behind Vanderbilt.
Michigan State and Washington real quickly here too. Is that a better game than I think? Sounds good.
You know, I'm excited to see. Look, Kalen DeBoer, wherever he has gone, NAIA, Division II, wherever Kalen DeBoer has gone, winning football has followed. And there is, again, in a small sample size, a distinct uptick in how Washington has played since he arrived. So I they're favored in that game, which
no, I think they're going to win. I just don't know that it's going to be a wildly entertaining game. That's all.
No, it could definitely be a slog. It could definitely be a slog. Might be a good day to stay on your boat in the lake.
Yeah. No. We don't want to keep people away from that stadium. We want them to go in and get excited about the Huskies. I'm a little bit of a Michigan State skeptic. I think they're ranked a little bit higher. Not that I don't think they're good. I do. But, you know, make a believer out of me, Sparty. You know, but 11 seems high to me a little bit right now. I think I have them in the 20s someplace. So
hard to hit portal roulette 2 years in a row. So I'm gonna wait and see that. I'm just not gonna assume that's happened.
Right, exactly, and maybe it has, and that eventually, outside of the Ohio State, Alabama, Georgia's of the world, outside of those, the coaches who do that best, at least until there's some other framework that changes it, those will be the teams that rise up from year to year. Agreed?
Yes, absolutely.
The big boys aren't going to have to do it, you know, but the other ones will. Mm-hmm. And how about the desperation that will be in College Station on Saturday night? And you have Miami coming in with 1,000 times better quarterback situation, opportunity to really, really send the old Aggies reeling, and Texas A&M, after the Appalachian State loss, desperate to get a victory against Miami. And it's based on what you saw, they couldn't stay on the field offensively against Appalachian State and couldn't get off of it on defense. You're kind of hard pressed to see how that's going to happen. But as we talked about old coaches early in there, Lou Holtz used to tell me all the time, it's a different team every week. Coach, you do not get the same football team from one week to the next. And so that's what the Aggies are banking on, is that they don't get the same football team that they had a week ago.
Do we think the Pollock prophecy comes through this week and the Haynes King era sputters to an end here and we see some Max Johnson or maybe some Connor Wiegman? Pollock, I give him credit on the podcast. He watched the film. He was very bullish on he's been on the Max Johnson bandwagon for a while, but he's very bullish on a quarterback change coming at A&M. And it would not surprise me if we do see, you have to do something. Right now, I will say this. App had the ball for 41 minutes.
Right.
So that's in credit them for the, you know, for the perfect strategy. You know, if you keep the ball away from them, they can't score. So it'll be very interesting to see how Jimbo responds. Were you surprised he sort of openly pondered giving up play calling?
A little bit because of my regard for him as a play caller. And I know that he is a very confident guy, but I think I alluded to this on the Monday podcast and I've applied it to Jimbo. The notion that David Shaw was talking to us about last week about institutional knowledge when you're at a place for a long time in David's case, or you know a lot, and then how much of that weighs you down in terms of how you ought to be thinking about your approach. He changed by going and incorporating a huge chunk of the Wake Forest slow mesh RPO type stuff. I think that applies to Jimbo in a different way, not in terms of institutional knowledge of Texas A&M, but institutional offense of a Jimbo Fisher offense, a Jimbo Fisher quarterback, and how they want to do things. Jimbo Fisher's forgotten more offense in the last 5 seconds than I'll ever know. I still think he's a really good offensive guy, terrific offensive guy, and a great developer of quarterbacks. I've always said that you know you're tough if you played quarterback for Jimbo Fisher. He is rough on those dudes. And I know you've, as I have, you've been to Jimbo Fisher practices, and it makes them better. But I get the sense that it's stale, and it may be, and this is for him to evaluate and me to opine on, it may be that he's weighed down by the institutional knowledge of what it means to be in a Jimbo Fisher offense, and perhaps there needs to be a reevaluation of that. And based on, you know, their up and down performances offensively, they've had moments, but they haven't been consistently great or explosive. Maybe it's time for that. So because of that, I guess maybe it didn't surprise me as much.
Yeah, I just think holistically there,
Reese, the sum is not greater than the parts right now. And the sum is not equal to the parts. And that falls directly on Jimbo Fisher. They have a lot of talented players, and a lot of them are young players too. You just don't get great recruiting classes and they're magically microwaved into all conference players. But you just can't argue pound for pound how much more talented they are than App State. And that requires a difficult autopsy of that program right now.
For sure. So we've given you what to look forward to when we come back on the podcast on Friday. It will be time to punch ourselves in the face, show you how bad we are at picking games. Although I think we're both close to 500, but overall in the season, I am tragic. But it'll be fun on Friday
when we come back and pick some games.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it. I'm due. I'm going to save it for Friday. I've got a new philosophy, or not a new philosophy, but I've reminded myself of a philosophy on picking games. So we'll be back with picks on Friday. Be sure to listen three times a week to the College Game Day podcast. Enjoy it wherever you download your podcast.